This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin political scientist talks about the effects that this week's news about abortion and the U.S. Supreme Court could have on Wisconsin's primary election in August and the general midterm in November. Now, Mother's Day is on Sunday. If you're scrambling to plan a special meal for mom, don't worry. We've got you covered. It's Food Friday. Today, it's all about the moms. A lot of us might have fond memories of growing up cooking with our mothers or that one recipe that no one else could make quite right. Mother's Day is the day we can show our appreciation with a good, maybe Sunday brunch. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you and your family celebrate Mother's Day with food? What makes a great Mother's Day meal? Does it have to be brunch? If you're a mom, what's your favorite food or recipe to have someone maybe make for you on Mother's Day? And hey, I'm trying to figure out what to make for my wife and mother-in-law on Sunday, and they're a tough crowd. No, I'm just kidding. They're very easygoing. But I do need ideas. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Katie Workman is a food writer for the Associated Press and contributor to Food 52 and TheKitchen.com. She's the author of the cookbooks Dinner Solved and The Mom 100 Cookbook. Her website is themom100.com. She's a mom herself. Katie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
Okay, let's start with that question. You know, when we think Mother's Day, I think we think Mother's Day brunch. Do you have a preference for brunch being the meal of Mother's Day?
You know, it's funny. I do think that often people sort of default to the brunch thought, but dinners also, lunches and dinners are also very popular. And I think, you know, much of it might depend on which time of the day you and your mom can get together. And, you know, then you also have the idea that there might be possibly more than one celebration because, you know, if you are a mother, you might hope that your children might do something for you. And if you are lucky enough to still have your mother, you might also want to do something for her. So I don't know that we should limit it to one meal. We've got 24 hours.
All right. Now, say we're in a routine where we do the same type of meal every year for Mother's Day. How can we mix it up this year if we want to?
Well, I think that often it's kind of fun to sort of take this moment to explore a different cuisine and maybe it's someplace that your mom's always wanted to go. Or maybe someplace that you've traveled with your mom and you want to sort of recreate those some favorite dishes or some favorite flavors. That's a nice way to sort of go about it. For me, my mom actually became vegetarian several years ago. So for the meal part that I will be making for her, I will be, you know, creating a mostly vegetarian meal and also some meatier aspects for the other people in our gang.
Now, mom isn't always the main cook in a house. Like I'm kind of the lead cook in our household, but for the situation, maybe somebody's listening saying, okay, yeah, she usually makes the dinners and brunches and whatnot. I want to give it a go. What are some simple things for that person who might not be the head chef in their own household?
Well, it's getting towards grilling season, depending on where you live in the country.
Oh, we're in Wisconsin. It's always grilling season.
So, and there's definitely hardcore grillers. I mean, if you are not, you know, the most adept cook, you can certainly pick up, you know, marinate some chicken or pick up a really good steak. Or if your mom's vegetarian, you can just get some beautiful vegetables and throw those on the grill. You really don't need anything more than a set of tongs, some salt, some olive oil, maybe some lemon juice, and you can, you know, just kind of look up cooking times and eyeball it. And, you know, just that's really simple. I also am a huge fan of grain salads. I think that, you know, just cooking up grains, which for the most part is no more difficult than cooking up a pot of rice or making pasta. And then using those grains and adding in vegetables, maybe dried fruit, making a nice vinaigrette. And I love to mix a lot of, sometimes I mix grains into, you know, green salads as well to give it a little bit more heft and more interest. So one of the dishes that I know I'm going to make some variation of this weekend is a kale and quinoa salad with dried cherries. And for that, all you have to do is you cook up your quinoa, which is 15 minutes, basically start to finish. And then you just do like kind of a pulsed mixture of parsley and mint and kale and scallions and, you know, some lemon juice and olive oil. And you just toss that together and throw in a few handfuls of dried cherries or cranberries. that's like if you want, you know, to add that little punch of sweet, tart, dried fruit. But it's such a flexible thought. You know, it's really, you can substitute any grains in. You can mix and match the herbs and the vegetables. You can just, you know, really play around with things that you might already have on hand.
It's Food Friday. And hey, good news. Our guest shared that recipe for kale and quinoa salad with dried cherries. We've got it up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Katie Workman is with us. She's written the cookbooks Dinner Solved and the Mom 100 Cookbook. Our theme today is getting ready for Mother's Day on Sunday. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about what to make on Sunday or how to make it, or if you want to share your menu for Mother's Day with us, love to hear it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Katie, you shared another recipe with us, and I gotta say, this one, it is on my maybe list for Sunday. A lazy oven French toast casserole. Like, I like making bread puddings, and this is kind of in the ballpark of a bread pudding almost. Tell us about this lazy oven French toast casserole.
Yes. I mean, I always sort of roll my eyes at my own recipe name because, of course, it's not your oven that's lazy. It's kind of maybe us. But, you know, the whole point of this casserole is, you know, everybody loves French toast and it's such a perfect Mother's Day brunch dish. But making individual slices of French toast for everybody can be time consuming and kind of, you know, take away from being at the table together. So this is basically like a strata or a bread pudding, as you said. And it's layers of challah, or you could use brioche. I love an egg-based bread in a French toast situation. It's just, it provides so much flavor. And you just slice it up, let it dry out a bit, and then you layer it with, you know, your basic mixture of sort of milk and eggs and a little bit of sugar, maple syrup, some cinnamon, touch of vanilla, and you layer it up again. You can throw some dried fruit or nuts into it if you want. And you just layer, you soak the bread in the custard mixture and cover it and throw it in the fridge overnight. And then the next morning you pull it out and you preheat the oven and you put it in the oven. And while you're doing that, you can put out some bowls of berries or, you know, some maple syrup, some softened butter, and, you know, pour some fresh squeezed orange juice. And when the casserole comes out, everybody can sit down and eat at the same time.
And let's talk about the premeditated angle of this, because when I do make my bread pudding types of things, I just mix them up and throw them in the oven. What am I going to get if I let it sit overnight?
It's just the bread is going to soak up everything. Nice. It's, you know, you don't have to let it sit overnight. You could let it sit for an hour or two. But, the point being, of course, if you want to get up in the morning and just have it ready to go in the oven and not have to start, you know, mixing and blending and fussing in the morning, you'll have it all done. But a couple hours will do it, and it just gives that bread, you know, it just saturates the bread. So you have that incredible, I mean, the top gets this beautiful kind of puffy crust, but the middle is like just creamy and completely delicious.
That sounds great. Now, I think a lot of people talk about the influence of cooking with a parent, a mom, and what they've learned from them and maybe passing to the next generation. We talk about that sometimes on Food Friday. Do you have things like that, that you're like, yeah, I got this from my mom, and or passing it on to your own kids?
Yeah, my mom was a really good cook. She was a very intuitive cook, and she was a pretty adventurous cook too. And she had some dishes that she had like project dishes that she would make for company. She made I remember, like, on special occasions, she would make a paella, which was, like, back in those days, it was really rare to come to somebody's home and have a paella served to you, and it probably still is. I can't think of that many paellas that have been served in somebody's home, and so she would, you know, really, you know, she'd have the saffron and the right rice and the seafood and, you know, just really sort of layer it up. But even now, she starts with a recipe and kind of just starts throwing things together, and she's just got a really good feel for ingredients and sort of experimentation, and I feel like that rubbed off on my sister and myself too.
Now, I got to say, having had little kids once upon a time, they're, you know, in college now, but adventurous was not always the word they were looking for in my cooking.
No.
Predictable and routine, I think.
Yes.
Did you find ways to get kids to appreciate those adventures and experiments?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just so much of it has to do with exposure, just having kids feel familiar with you know, different flavors, whether they're being trying them at a restaurant or you're experimenting a little more at home. And it's just it's repeated exposure and the sort of like getting comfortable and not sort of sticking to your rut, which of course puts your kids in a rut, but you know, and being patient. I mean, there's a lot of ways to go about this. There's the, you know, take one bite rule. There's the, you know, and you figure out what works for your family. But I mean, I'm not a proponent of you're going to eat everything on your plate or you're not leaving the table. I'm not the biggest fan of that. I think that tends to backfire, but just, you know, this, I'm not putting so much pressure on things. And I always think of this one dinner where my kids were really little and they were sitting at a table and there was a bunch of teenagers in our group and they were all just happily eating. I remember it was a curried squash, butternut squash, I think, soup or a pumpkin soup. Ooh. And my kids just sat there and they just like ate the soup along with these kids because they just like weren't going to, they didn't want to look like the picky little kids at the big kid table. So if you can just sort of like, again, keep exposing them and sort of make food feel like something that's sort of joyful and, you know, fun to try and just keep at it and try not to like engage in the control thing. You know, it's really hard as a parent. I'm the first to say, but the more pressure you put on your kids to eat certain things or be adventurous, you know, it tends to become a rebellious moment because little kids especially don't have all that much control in their life. One thing they really can control is what they put on their fork and put in their mouth. So, you know, if you don't engage in sort of the power struggle, it often becomes less of a power struggle.
We're talking to food writer and cookbook author Katie Workman about Mother's Day meals for this week's edition of Food Friday. Katie's the author of Dinner Solved and the Mom 100 Cookbook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. On a practical level, do you need advice for your upcoming Mother's Day meal, or do you want to share your plans, maybe your tradition? Is there something that happens every year on Mother's Day? And what influence did maybe your own mom have on your cooking? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Katie Workman, author of the cookbooks Dinner Solved and the Mom 100 Cookbook. She's a food writer also for the Associated Press. She's with us today on Food Friday to help us cook a great meal for Mother's Day. Katie gave us a couple recipes, a kale and quinoa salad, and this awesome-sounding oven-baked French toast arrangement. Find those at WPR.org/Food Friday, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a mom, what is the best Mother's Day meal that's ever been served to you, whether it was a big fancy production or maybe a bowl of cereal lovingly prepared by a two-year-old? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know your traditions, what's on your menu for Sunday, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Adrian on Facebook who writes, "My mom's been gone for nearly 50 years, but she taught me most of what I know, from how to make bread to turning me loose with a cookbook to cook for 40 people. Still love the old favorites like cinnamon rolls. No written recipe. It was a given that you could make these. But like to explore recipes from all over. A great gift from my mom." And Katie, that no written recipe reminds me, I've definitely had family members where they might try to teach you to cook something. Mm-hmm. It might not be written down somewhere. Have you found good ways to convey those kind of traditional family recipes that were just winging it in some cases?
I know, and I will say in general, the best sort of cooks, the moms and the grandmothers, and this is true, like Jewish, Italian, Mexican, like every, you know, the best cooks often don't have a recipe and they eyeball everything and they don't even have measurements to share. So I've had many friends be like, you know, and I was trying to watch my Nona and she did, you know, she was throwing in a handful and I was like, wait, how much Parmesan is that? And there's rarely an answer. It's like, you know, it's just, So I think, you know, if you are lucky enough to have one of these cooking teachers in your life, then, you know, taking the time to sort of show up in the kitchen, bring a pad and a pen and or your computer and just say, you know, I'd love to try to like slow it down and capture this so that I can, you know, have this recipe forever. And I, you know, by and large, most people are pretty flattered and excited to think that their recipes are going to live on and, you know, prosper after they're gone. So it's really a worthy thing to do. And I have a ginger snap recipe that was my great grandmother's, and I'm sure it really wasn't hers. I don't think she created it, but you know, it's really nice to think that your ginger snaps are, you know, if not the same, based similar to the ones that your great, it was my great grandmother actually. So, you know, these, you know, there's still a lot of people also have these wonderful collections of recipe cards or things that they've ripped out of newspapers over the years. And I love it when I sometimes buy an old cookbook, like at a thrift store or flea market. And then inside the cookbook, there's some handwritten recipes tucked in between the pages. Mm. And you just, there's just something so personal about it. And you just can sort of like vaguely imagine somebody clipping something in 1970 and, you know, tucking it into their Betty Crocker book or whatever.
Adrian, thanks for sharing that story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's Food Friday, talking to Katie Workman, author of Dinner Solved and the Mom 100 Cookbook, getting ideas for Mother's Day. Still time for your comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday, and still time for you to call in, if you like, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Katie, I know a lot of times there will be a tradition of bringing the kids, maybe littler kids, in to help with a Mom's Day meal. What are some good things that kids can really, you know, feel a sense of accomplishment helping out in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. Both cookbooks, both in the Mom 100 and Dinner Solved, in for each recipe, I give advice on what the kids can help do, because I do agree that it is super important to bring them into the kitchen. The earlier, the better. And even if they're not really that helpful at the beginning, it's you know, you're sort of paying it forward so that when they get older, they'll have that confidence and hopefully just also an appreciation for food. And kids are very much more likely to try something if they've had a hand in making it. So that's another reason to get the kids there. And, you know, just thinking about age-appropriate tasks, you know, like obviously bigger kids who are more adept in the kitchen can do a lot, but little kids, they can, you know, say you need some fresh herbs, you can ask them to pull the oregano leaves off the stem or crack an egg or measure flour or whisk something. You know, be careful about feet and knives, of course, and supervise, you know, unless you are 100% positive that your kid is capable of doing a particular task, don't, you know, take your eyes off them. But really, we all know the mother, in my case, you know, me, I don't care what they make me. That's the truth. I really don't care. I just, you know, especially when they're little, it's just like, it's so just delightful to have your kids sort of do something like that for you. And hopefully also with the help of maybe your partner, remember to clean up, because nothing takes away from the joy of a Mother's Day meal like a sink full of dirty dishes. I can tell you that right now. But, you know, it really truly is kind of the thought that counts. And, you know, yes, you want to try to pick something that you know your mom's going to like. And yes, you want to put a little bit of attention in it. You know, try to make the meal visually appealing as well as tasty. But I don't think there's been a mom who has had a Mother's Day meal prepared for her with the help of her children who's ever been like, well, that stunk.
Funny. Let's bring on a caller now. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. This is kind of a bittersweet story, but when my sister many years ago had ovarian cancer and was fairly sure that she wasn't going to make it through. And so that year, when she had a lot of time to sit and think, she was a really good cook and could like look at what was in the refrigerator and make something out of it. But she never wrote any of those things down. So she tried to think of all of the meals that she had made that the kids really liked, that her husband really liked, all of that. And she wrote them all down so that all three of them would have them. And I mean, her kids were in fifth grade and seventh grade. They were cooking by that time, but, you know, they still have them today and they're in their late 30s.
Wow. Susie, thank you so much for sharing that. And Katie, that really speaks to the memories we can attach to the food that that our parents, our moms in this case, make.
Yeah, Susie, thank you so much for sharing that. And it is like such a very personal little legacy to leave your kids, and so thoughtful of her to do that. And I'm sure it means so much to them to have these recipes now and to, you know, especially if, you know, when they were, you know, when she passed, if they were really little, they might sort of have the memories of these dishes, but they might be sort of fuzzier. So to have this written down so that they can sort of recreate some of it is just beautiful.
Susie, thanks so much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Katie, in just our last few moments, do you know what's on menus, whether the part you're making or the part that's being made for you on Sunday?
Well, I am hoping that breakfast is not my problem and that my kids and my husband show up in some way for that. And then in the afternoon, actually, I'm speaking to Susie's sort of bittersweetness. I just lately have had a number of family members and friends lose their mothers in the past recent weeks, even, and months. And so we're actually, it's very nice. We're getting together with some very good family friends, one of whom has just lost his mom. And he called me and he said, can we have Mother's Day with you and your mom this year? And we do a lot together, so it wasn't sort of out of the blue. But I said, absolutely. So, you know, so we're sharing my mom this year.
That's lovely. Katie, thanks so much for joining us. That's Katie Workman, food writer, author of the cookbooks Dinner Solved and the Mom 100 Cookbook. She joined us for Food Friday for Mother's Day. Find a couple of her recipes online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Competition can inspire amazing acts of human achievement, and the Guinness Book of World Records marks some of the weirdest of those achievements. In one of their categories, there's been an escalating record, with the latest one set just last month in the category of stacking M&M candies. As reported by Yahoo News, I found this via Metafilter, the record for the most M&Ms successfully stacked on top of one another was set last month by a 29-year-old in Iraq. The new record, 7. M&Ms. Turns out it's really hard to stack a single width tower of M&Ms. The original mark was set in 2016 at 4. It's been broken 3 times since then. The current record holder used special gloves and a steady hand to hit the 7 mark. Also, the same guy holds the record for the most balanced eggs on the back of the hand. 18 of them. And that one could get a lot messier. Keep reaching for the stars. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin has a primary election coming up Tuesday, August 9th. It's a big election year with Democratic Governor Tony Evers running for a second term. There's a field of potential Republican challengers, and multiple Democrats are running to challenge incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson. While primaries, even midterms, tend to have much lower voter turnout than presidential elections, this week's leaked Supreme Court draft opinion that would, if it holds up, overturn Roe v. Wade has gotten a lot of attention focused on voting. Could that bring more people to the polls this year? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has your attention when it comes to this August primary? Are you paying attention yet? Are you interested in choosing a candidate, a Democrat to run against Ron Johnson, a Republican to run against Tony Evers? What do those candidates have to do to make you pick them as the one? Or do you not care? You'll vote for whoever is on the ballot, even if it's a Muppet, if it gives you a chance of unseating an incumbent you don't like. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julia Azari is Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. Julia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with this draft opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court, potentially overturning Roe v. Wade later this summer. How do you see that shaking up elections, if at all, this year?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think there's a couple of ways that this could go. The first one, which you've undoubtedly heard a lot about, is the possibility that this kind of galvanizes Democrats who have typically been less motivated by judicial issues and court issues than Republicans. And I think that's something that has gotten a lot of attention because, of course, the upcoming midterms don't look like great conditions for the Democrats. It's never really a great situation for the president's party, and we're in a situation in which the Democrats are receiving low marks on their performance on important issues like the economy, and Biden isn't very popular. So I think that a lot of politics watchers who are kind of either on the Democratic side or looking at the broader picture of the Democrats are going to be looking at kind of, does this have mobilization potential to energize Democratic voters who may otherwise be a little bit disenchanted with the way things are going right now in politics?
You said there are a couple of ways of looking at it. So one way is, yes, it could inspire Democratic voters, or?
Yeah, the other way is maybe doesn't have totally different implications, but I think is really an important kind of conversation about the politics of this that I want to invite the listeners into, which is this question of kind of polarization around the issue of abortion. I think it's very clear that there's a big partisan gap on this, just like there's a big partisan gap on basically every single thing right now. But when you look at various types of polling, it becomes clear that really within both parties, there's kind of a range of opinion. And there's been a debate raging about this in among political scientists for well over a decade about whether Americans are truly polarized on this issue at the kind of mass level of people in the electorate, or if most people fall somewhere in the middle. And 10 years ago, I would have told you that a Supreme Court decision of this magnitude on this issue would have the potential to divide either party, is anybody's guess. Now, I feel like that has changed a little bit. And we've had a number of kind of, you know, high profile anti-abortion Democrats no longer in politics, like Michigan's Bart Stupak. Whereas I feel like one possibility is that with Republicans, given the nature of this decision and what people think the fallout will be, if it becomes a situation in which abortion is completely illegal in a number of states and some of the other kinds of big implications we're seeing, that might actually have the possibility of dividing Republicans, people who are mostly, you know, perhaps say mostly I don't support this, but maybe I see some room for exception. This is the way the issue is currently structured, with those really strong restrictions that are likely to come out of some states. I think that has the potential to be a wedge in that within that coalition, and not so much press at the divisions among Democrats, even though certainly those divisions exist.
I want to spend a little more time on that Pew poll you pointed out toward us. I think it's easy, especially from a vantage point in the media, to think that there's a very strong pro-choice group out there. They would describe themselves as a very strong self-described pro-life group. One's totally against abortion, one's totally for choice. That poll shows a lot of middle ground and variation and uncertainty in the middle.
Yeah, I think that's essentially what, you know, some political scientists have been kind of advocating for that perspective in terms of how to understand the polarization around this issue. The other interesting thing about some of the Pew data that's come out over the last couple of months is that Republicans have been very steady on this issue in terms of the percentage who think abortion should be legal in most or some cases. I think it's all or some cases. Whereas Democrats have, this is again kind of voters in the mass electorate, have become more pro-choice over time. I don't know how that really will play out in November or or, you know, in the time in between them. But it is, I think it's kind of interesting as we're thinking about how the parties have kind of coalesced around this issue. I certainly would have told you in the past, you know, in the past couple of years, this is a really key issue for devoted Republican activists, and that being able to convey support for the anti-abortion and pro-life position for Donald Trump was really key in consolidating a Republican Party that was initially kind of unsure about him in 2016. But at the same time, that is different from the kind of policy change that I think we're kind of looking at potentially, if that draft opinion is at all representative of what the court will eventually decide.
We're talking to Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at Wisconsin's election year, big statewide races for governor and U.S. Senate. We've been talking so far about the potential impact of this potential ruling on Roe v. Wade from the U.S. Supreme Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does that likely decision affect how you vote? Do you think it will affect the election overall? Call 800-642-1234. Julia, glancing at the primaries for a moment, we've got Republicans lining up to run against Governor Evers. We've got Democrats lining to run up against Senator Johnson. We heard from the latest Marquette University Law School poll from Charles Franklin that the leader, both those races, is don't know. What would it take for candidates to distinguish themselves, you think, and stand out, whether it's on an issue like abortion or otherwise?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, I think it's instructive to think about the fact that a couple of other Midwestern states just had their primaries this week, Indiana and Ohio. And it did, I mean, they have winners, but it also in some ways kind of looked like the winner was still don't know in terms of the decisiveness of some of the big contests. I'm thinking of the sort of three major candidates competing for the Senate nomination in Ohio. I think that this is a tricky time for primaries because the parties are, in terms of their kind of broad stances, there's so little variation. And you do have these issues, you know, as we were just talking about with abortion, where there's a lot of room for these like really complicated and nuanced positions. And a primary election doesn't strike me as really a great venue to hammer out those nuanced details. So candidates have to think about other ways to distinguish themselves and other things to emphasize. And it wouldn't surprise me very much if on the right, on the Republican side, this sort of leads candidates to double down on other types of issues on which they want to distinguish themselves. There already has been some contestation in that Republican gubernatorial primary about the 2020 election and about the kind of lack of the perceived idea that Rebecca Clayfish has a lack of support for Donald Trump's position on the 2020 election that he actually won and won in the state of Wisconsin, a claim for which there is not any evidence, and some Republicans in the state have kind of moved on from that. But that's also a point of weakness for Republicans who've taken that position, and Clayfish is not an exception. On the Democratic side, it seems to me like the interesting thing about that race is it's tightening. And it does seem to be, there does seem to be a possibility that will come down to being kind of like the same dynamics as the 2020 Democratic presidential primary, which is to say all about electability. And that's, I think, going to have a lot to do with name recognition and with the types of claims that these candidates might make about either their potential to win statewide or their records winning statewide, which Godlewski and Barnes both have.
We're talking about the August primary and general elections later this year with Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, big statewide races for governor and U.S. Senate. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you paying attention to these primary races? What do you want for your party, if you affiliate yourself with the party? What do you want from your candidate for governor or Senate? Are you pulling for the incumbent in either of those races? What issues do you want candidates talking about? What issues do you want us in the media to be talking about over the next few months? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about election year in Wisconsin with Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching the races for governor or Senate, the primaries especially, or are you holding off? What issues are important to you? Are there endorsements from current or former presidents of the United States, say, that you're watching for? Call 800-642-1234. And what do you think about this potential overturning of Roe v. Wade and how it could affect the vote, your vote? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller. Isaac is with us in Milwaukee. Isaac, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Isaac?
I just called in because I am planning to turn in a blank ballot for the governor's race in Wisconsin this year.
And why is that?
I think that we have historically low voter turnout rates, and they've only been getting lower, you know, each election with some exceptions, but that's the long-term trend. And I think that that's the case maybe because a lot of the people who don't vote, in a way, are, you know, I hate to say it, but smarter than a lot of us who've been trying to give the Democrats our vote over and over again, you know. And I just say that because I think that we've got two major parties who, you know, are very unpopular, but have still managed anyway to continue running the system. And they're both fighting in very different ways culturally, but they're both fighting for the, you know, the elite and the ultra wealthy and the business class. And I just think that we need a party for workers and the poor and, you know, the bottom half of this country who are working every day and, you know, ultimately making less money.
Isaac, thanks for the call. Julia, there are a lot of people who don't vote, especially in non-presidential elections. Do you think some of them may share Isaac's motivation?
Sure. There's a lot of discussion about why people don't vote. I mean, one interesting thing is that over nationally, over the last couple of election cycles, even though I think a lot of people share Isaac's sentiment that they feel really shut out of the political process, they feel like things haven't gotten better for them. Turnout has actually gotten higher. I think because even though that perception and that widespread sense of dissatisfaction is there, that relative to 20 years ago, the kind of issue differences between the two parties have still been really evident. I guess it depends on what issues and what policy outcomes you care the most about. But turnout has actually gotten higher. That's kind of like the silver lining of party polarization. But I do, you know, I do really hear that dissatisfaction and that sense that no matter who is in office, life has not improved for some people. And you know, I've done some work with one of my graduate students on what people write in kind of open questions on surveys about why they don't trust or have confidence in institutions. And we see a lot of the kinds of comments that Isaac was making about, particularly about political parties. They see this as primarily for the elites, for people with money, and not for them. And I don't have any easy answers or even any difficult ones.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about election year in Wisconsin with Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. You can join in with your thoughts about the race for governor, the race for Senate, your hopes, your fears in those races, and whether the Roe v. Wade makes you pay more attention to them. This leaked draft document from the U.S. Supreme Court that indicates maybe overturning Roe v. Wade. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Julia, as you mentioned, a couple of primary votes have come in now. A lot of people looking at the influence of former President Donald Trump. We have a very small sample size here. What are you looking at when it comes to whether his enthusiastic endorsement makes a difference?
I'm looking at a couple things, and some of them are going to be easier to really get a handle on than others. The one that I think is easier to get a handle on is kind of what kinds of candidates are being endorsed by the former president, and is he endorsing candidates who otherwise, you know, aren't very likely to win? And, it, you know, in the last couple of cycles, Trump has been very strategic about endorsing candidates who are likely to win, which I think really makes, you know, like makes a kind of self-reinforcing cycle where he looks really powerful in the party. When people perceive you to be powerful in the party, you are. So I'm looking for those sorts of endorsements. That did make the Vance endorsement very interesting, the Senate race in Ohio, because it didn't look like J.D. Vance was necessarily going to be a very strong candidate up until fairly close to the election when he was endorsed by the former president. The more complicated issue I'm kind of looking at is the difference between an actual Trump endorsement and a kind of dividing line between candidates who align themselves with Trump and kind of Trumpism, the kind of Trump positions and political style, and the, you know, kind of candidates who are running as an alternative vision within the Republican Party, of which there are, you know, there are a few, including the candidate, the third place finisher in the Ohio Senate primary. So I'm kind of looking at those dynamics, both what is the kind of strength of the alternative position in the Republican Party, but also what is the relative strength of Trump as the person versus Trump as the idea. And that includes looking at candidates who are really trying to take Trumpism to kind of the next level and potentially be competitors to the former president who want to take that vision and kind of run with it. And, you know, like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, I think, is a good example of that. So I'm kind of looking at whether we also have prominent candidates like that who are, I call them interpreters of Trumpism. That might be kind of a clunky phrase, but all will forgive me.
In a state like Wisconsin now, where, again, don't know, is leading the Republican field for governor, is that a case where you see a Trump endorsement making enough of a marginal difference to help somebody emerge from the pack?
I mean, that one seems unclear. I mean, a somewhat different read. I was looking at the Marquette poll. I was looking at the Real Clear Politics average, and it looks like Clayfish is a pretty strong favorite at this point. Maybe that could obviously change. And these polls didn't even include Michaels. But I do think that if there were, you know, if it becomes close, if it starts to look like the Democratic Senate primary where it starts to tighten, then that's where you might see an endorsement. You might see an endorsement make a difference.
Now, turning to other possible issues, we've talked a little bit about the 2020 election still being in there. Abortion, of course, a big one. You mentioned the economy earlier, and we're going to talk about the economy and all the yes, but on the other hand, things. Great job numbers, bad inflation numbers, and you can go back and forth for a while. How do you watch for that asserting itself in these races?
I think the main thing that we've learned over the years is that, you know, the economy tends to be people's number one issue. So the question then is, how do people perceive the economy, and how does that interact with their partisan identification? So, like you said, there's this very confusing situation where there's, you know, good jobs numbers, bad overall economic ratings because of perceptions of inflation. I also think there's probably something going on with COVID. People are just kind of grumpy and dissatisfied. I mean, I think everyone has had a rough time the last 2 years. I think that we don't quite know what a midterm election looks like under those conditions, right? We don't really have a roadmap for that. We also learned in 2020 that the role of the economy seems to be tempered by bipartisanship. And what I mean by that is that if you just looked at the economic numbers and you ran them through the model that political scientists have been using to predict elections, which has been pretty good, Trump massively overperformed. He did much better than you would expect given the state of the economy and in fall 2020. And so, you know, one question there is, are there people who identify as Democrats who might go, grumble, grumble, I am not happy with the economy, I'm not even super happy with Biden, but, you know, fundamentally, this is my identification, my team, my perspective, and vote that way nonetheless. I did see a primary poll, a midterm poll that was sort of reflective of that. Democrats were doing really badly on a bunch of different issues. Republicans were doing badly on some as well. And then it was like, well, who are you thinking to vote for? And it was like 44, 43 Republicans to Democrats, right? Like, people have all these ideas about how things are going, and ultimately it comes down to their partisanship.
So briefly, issues may not matter as much anymore?
That's one possibility. We're because of the pandemic, because of the level of polarization, because of the unique circumstances of the 2020 election, I think we're a little bit in uncharted territory as far as what we might be able to say about the larger dynamics of this 2020 or 2022 midterm.
Julia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We talked with her about this year's election in Wisconsin, how current events, including this week's leaked Supreme Court opinion, potentially overturning Roe v. Wade, could shake things up. Coming up Monday on Central Time, working at customer service jobs can take a lot of draining emotional labor, even in normal times. And the pandemic, well, it made things even more stressful. We'll look at the strain on a huge part of the workforce. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.